Headlines: Russia and Ukraine are holding new round of face-to-face negotiations in Turkey in a bid to end the 34-day conflict. Pakistani opposition supporters rally in Islamabad as parliament prepares for a no-confidence vote against embattled prime minister. Also ahead, Iran welcomes a 3-day ceasefire announced by Yemen's Supreme Political Council as an initiative to end the Saudi-led war and blockade. A fresh attempt at diplomacy. Now, this is our first news story. I'm Gisumisha Ahmadi from Tehran. A fresh attempt at diplomacy is underway between Russia and Ukraine in the Turkish city of Islamabad as the conflict rages on. The face-to-face talks between negotiators from the warring sides is an effort towards ending the month-long military confrontation. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan addressed the delegates, saying that the talks would pave the way for a meeting of the two countries' leaders. He also called for an immediate ceasefire. Russia and Ukraine held their first high-level talks in Turkey's Antalya on March 10th, but failed to reach a consensus. After that, they have held regular talks via video conference, but with no major breakthrough. The Kremlin spokesman says Russia will only resort to nuclear weapons if its very existence is threatened.
But any outcome of the operation, of course, is not a reason for usage of a nuclear weapon. We have a security concept that very clearly states that only when there is a threat for existence of the state in our country, we can use and we will actually use nuclear weapons.
Dmitry Peskov said not any scenario in the conflict with Ukraine will be the grounds for using a nuclear weapon. President Vladimir Putin last month ordered Russia's nuclear forces to be on high alert. The country has approximately 6,000 nuclear warheads, the largest stockpile in the world. Peskov also said Russia is convinced that NATO is a machine of confrontation and not cooperation and security. He noted that Moscow does not accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court. The tribunal has opened an investigation into possible war crimes in Ukraine, but the prosecutor says Russia has not responded to his request for contributions. We talked to political commentator Scott Bennett to get his opinion. He believes that the odds of Russia using a nuclear weapon are very low.
Well, I don't think there's any chance of Russia using nuclear weapons in an offensive capacity. It is making the declaration that it will not tolerate any attacks upon it, be it in the form of conventional weapons, nuclear weapons, or, as we've recently discovered, biological and chemical weapons. So I think Russia is recognizing that it is doubling down on its economic war against NATO and the United States for its declarations of war by demanding oil be produced in rubles and sold on that monetary system. Of course, this is being challenged by Europe. So this is a Russian positioning itself for defense, but I don't think there's any real danger. There is almost a laughable hypocrisy in NATO and the United Nations and the World Criminal Court trying to charge Russia with war crimes, because as we're seeing every day, the evidence of war crimes is coming out that the Biden administration and members of the United States government have been involved in funding war crimes in the form of biological and chemical weapons.
The UN chief says the solution to the Russian-Ukraine conflict is political and not humanitarian, adding that the global body is seeking a ceasefire between the two neighbors. Antonio Guterres hoped the UN humanitarian chief would travel to both Moscow and Kiev as soon as possible to explore the grounds for a humanitarian ceasefire. Over a month, Russian attacks on Ukraine has taken a heavy toll on civilian lives and infrastructure. Ukrainian officials say almost 5,000 people have been killed in the southern city of Mariupol alone since Russian forces laid siege on it. Kiev says the war has so far cost close to 565 billion dollars in terms of damage and infrastructure, lost economic growth, and other factors. Ukraine's officials also say that they have proof Russian forces have used banned cluster bombs in the two southern regions of Odessa and Kherson. Moscow has already denied these allegations. Supporters of opposition political parties in Pakistan have staged a rally against Prime Minister Imran Khan in the capital, Islamabad. The rally came hours after the parliament took up a no-confidence motion pushed by opposition lawmakers to remove Khan from power. The House will begin the debate on the motion on Thursday, and a vote will be held within 7 days. Khan lost a parliamentary majority with a series of deflections from his Tehreek-e-Insaf party, leaving him reliant on coalition allies to stay in power. Khan's opponents believe they have enough votes to unseat him. Pakistan is currently grappling with soaring inflation and unemployment, with accusations of corruption and mismanagement plaguing the government. Khan says a foreign-funded plot is underway to topple him. Our correspondent Kamran Yusuf says the demonstrations against Imran Khan are part of the political turmoil in Pakistan.
As far as rallies are concerned, this is, of course, part of the overall political tension that is brewing in Pakistan since opposition moved a no-confidence motion. We saw a couple of days back, Prime Minister Imran Khan showed his street power in Islamabad, and in response to government's rally, opposition parties last night also gathered on the main highway in the capital, Islamabad, where opposition leaders made fiery speeches and were confident that their move to remove Prime Minister Imran Khan through a vote of no confidence will succeed. As far as the vote of no confidence is concerned, the formal process was kicked off yesterday. Now the session of the National Assembly, the lower house of Pakistan's parliament, will meet again on Thursday when the debate will start on the vote of no confidence. As per the Pakistani constitution, once the resolution is tabled inside the National Assembly, the voting has to take place within 7 days. So we expect that by early next week, the voting will take place and we will have the answer whether Prime Minister Imran Khan will survive.
Iran welcomes Yemen's new peace initiative to end the Saudi-led war. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says the proposed plan shows the determination of Sana'a to bring an end to the war and blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia through political means. He hoped that by giving priority to humanitarian issues and promoting the exchange of prisoners, the crisis would be resolved. Sana'a has announced a unilateral ceasefire, saying it is ready for a permanent truce if Riyadh withdraws its forces, halts supporting a local militia, and ends its siege. Since March 2015, the war has killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, either directly or indirectly. The UN says the war and blockade have made Yemen the worst humanitarian crisis. And as Europe continues to struggle for an alternative source of oil to replace Russian crude, Yemen's war has once again hit the headlines. This after a series of retaliatory strikes by the Yemeni army successfully hit a key Saudi oil infrastructure last week. With petrol prices reaching epic highs, could the Saudi-led war on Yemen cause more economic hardship on European consumers? Robert Carter reports.
In the aftermath of Yemen's blistering retaliatory strike on Saudi Arabia's Aramco oil facilities, crude oil prices shot up by over $120 a barrel. Yemen's military spokesperson revealed that the operation had been carried out in response to continued Saudi-led aggression.
Yemen will not hesitate to widen its military operation until the end of the aggression and breaking of the siege. Allah is witness to what we say.
With the threat of future attacks looming, many fear that Saudi's seemingly endless war on Yemen could negatively contribute to economic instability in Europe.
Now we are seeing it's affecting the pounds and the pennies. It's not just Britain. Look at the price of the gasoline and the petrol in the United States, in Germany, everywhere else. everything is connected, you know, and I think the fact of the matter is, today's world, we can't commit these sort of atrocities on one side and think it's not going to come and bite us back later on. And now we are seeing very clear indication of direct impact on our pounds and pennies.
With the relationship between Russia and the West continuing to crumble, Riyadh hopes that it can use this opportunity and Europe's desperate need to replace Russian oil to its own advantage. However, with Yemen's ability to hit key Saudi oil infrastructure at will, serious questions are being raised about the reliability of Saudi as an oil-producing partner. Robert Carter, London.
To Peru now, where President Pedro Castillo has survived an impeachment vote in Congress. Overall, 55 out of 130 lawmakers voted in favor of the impeachment, but the Congress needed 87 votes to oust Castillo. This will prevent a new political crisis in the short term, although Castillo's administration has been turbulent anyway, with four cabinets during its less than a year in office. He's been facing accusations of graft that he denies. Similarly, last year, the president survived an impeachment attempt. Back then, he argued that he had not broken the law since taking office and called for unity to deal with the political and economic crisis. Polls show Castillo is facing a plummeting approval rating, hovering around 25%. And Canada's Indigenous people meet Pope Francis in the Vatican, asking for an apology for the abuse and death of children in Catholic church-run residential schools.
Untold numbers have now left us without ever having their truths heard and their pain acknowledged, without ever receiving the very basic humanity and healing they so rightfully deserved. That is nothing short of a travesty, both of justice and of conscience. And while the time for acknowledgement, apology, and atonement is long overdue, it is never too late to do the right thing.
That was the Pope's first of four meetings with representatives of Native peoples referred to as the process of healing. But the survivors of residential schools asked the pontiff for free access to church records on the institutions where children were abused. There was no apology yet from the Pope. However, Indigenous people expect him to visit Canada and make an apology there. Last year, the remains of 215 children were discovered at a former boarding school in British Columbia. Hundreds more unmarked burial sites have been found since. The schools, run mostly by a Catholic church, aim to assimilate Indigenous children between the 1830s and the 1990s.
Hey everyone, Ali Reza here, back with another hashtag trending. Pope Francis is hosting a group of Canadian Indigenous leaders to discuss the Roman Catholic Church's role in the Canadian residential school system following multiple discoveries of unmarked mass graves at the former sites. The Indigenous elders and residential school survivors say that they expect nothing less than a public apology from the Pope for the sufferings inflicted upon the Indigenous people. They also want to address the role of the Catholic Church in the suppression of Indigenous languages, culture, and spirituality. In June, Pope Francis expressed pain at the discovery of the unmarked graves, but stopped short of offering the apology. Now many are saying that the Pope and the Catholic Church owe much more than a mere apology to start a reconciliation process with the Indigenous people of Canada. Our first tweet of the day comes from Now Is In Effect. The Catholic Church owes Indigenous peoples of Canada much more than an apology. They should disband their church organization at the very least. But clearly followers of the Pope aren't ethical people. Mrs. Carla Robson-David tweeted, I really hope that the Pope will recognize the damage the Catholic Church has done to Indigenous peoples in residential schools. Please apologize to our Indigenous peoples to start the Church's process of reconciliation, recovery. Don't let Canadians down this time. Philip MacLeod, or MacLeod, excuse the mispronunciation if there was one, if reconciliation is to advance in Canada, the Pope needs to do a lot more than just listen when an Indigenous delegation meets with him this week. And here's another tweet by Ashish Basu. Insightful conversation. The Catholic Church and the Pope owes not only an apology but reparations to survivors and their families and heirs. The Catholic Church has billions. It is inconceivable that those who supposedly serve God could be so heinous. While the discovery of Canada's unmarked mass graves of Indigenous people goes viral, activists are sounding the alarm on the plight of Canada's marginalized communities. They say that it is completely unacceptable that Indigenous people don't have access to clean drinking water, while Canada is home to 20% of the world's freshwater reserves. Our next comment comes from CJF. She's 80, has never flown on a plane, and she's headed to Rome to ask the Pope for an apology following the abuse she suffered in Canada's residential school system. Over here, we have a tweet by Linda W.S. Nearly three-quarters of Canada's 130 residential schools were run by Roman Catholic missionary congregations, which an estimated 150,000 Indigenous children were forced to attend. And unfortunately, thousands of these children are believed to be dead attending while attending these institutions. Ryan Reynolds has our next tweet. Canada's home to 20% of Earth's freshwater. There's no acceptable reason Indigenous communities don't have access to clean, safe water. That'll do it for another edition of Hashtag Trending. Many thanks. Time to get back to the studio for the rest of the world news.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered on June 3, 2016 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of 27th anniversary of Imam Khomeini's passing. The speech was delivered at Imam Khomeini's shrine in Tehran, Iran.
Take note, it is 100 years now that America and England have been pressuring the people of Palestine. They have been doing so before the formation of the Zionist regime in the year 1948 and after that, till this day. Well, this is how global imperialism moves. Islam cannot remain silent on this matter. The Islamic government cannot see this and be indifferent. Global imperialism is directly helping those who bomb the people of Yemen. America is openly and directly helping with the bombardment of Yemen. Which areas do they bomb the front lines? No, they bomb hospitals, markets, schools, and public squares. America is helping them. Well, the Islamic Republic cannot remain indifferent towards these issues. These two systems are battling one another. They are opposed to one another by nature. How can this enmity be defined? America launched the coup d'etat of the 28th of Mordad and toppled the national government. America has been displaying enmity towards us from the beginning of the revolution until today. During the time of Tarut, Pahlavi era, America established Savak, which tortures the people and revolutionary fighters of Iran.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In the 8-year war, America did its best to help our enemy. America struck down one of our passenger planes. America struck our old platforms. America imposed sanctions on us. Is this not enmity? Any individual and orientation that works for Islam or in the name of Islam trust America. They have made a grave mistake, which will be slapped in the face for, as they were slapped in the past. In recent years, Islamic orientations trusted and established a friendship with Americans because of their interest. Because of political wisdom, they referred to this as a political wisdom. And because of tactical reasons, they claimed it was necessary for tactical moves. Consequently, they were punished and felt that slap across their face. And in the present time, they are enduring disasters that originated from that mistake. Of course, we have many small and big enemies. We have small and cruel enemies as well. But the main enmity comes from America and from England. Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Thousands of Yemenis have staged mass protests across the country, including the capital Sana'a, on the National Day of Resilience, the day when the Saudi-led coalition began its aggression on Yemen. The demonstrators marked the 7th anniversary of the Saudi-led war on their country, denounced the aggression, and expressed their support for resistance against the Saudi-led invasion. The demonstrations followed a wave of retaliatory drone and missile attacks that hit targets across Saudi Arabia.
In response to the ongoing unjust siege on our country and our people, the Yemen Armed Forces underwent the third breaking siege operation through ballistic missiles and drones in the following manner. We targeted Aramco facilities in Jeddah and other locations in the capital of our Saudi enemy, Riyadh.
Facilities belonging to the Saudi state oil company, Aramco, were also hit in Jizan and Najran in the south. The Yemeni army also says it launched drone attacks against oil refineries in the east of the kingdom. According to the army, multiple vital targets in several other locations, including in Abha in Asir region, have also been hit by ballistic missiles. This is the Yemeni army's highest profile attack yet on the kingdom. The army vowed to continue the retaliatory military operations until Riyadh stops its years-long aggression and lifts its all-out siege on Yemen. Retaliatory missile and drone strikes against oil storage facilities in Saudi Arabia rekindled concerns over supply shortages as crude oil prices surged and broke the $120 level. The news added fuel to the already volatile oil market, shadowed by supply risks related to the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Meanwhile, Saudi Arabia has launched a series of attacks against Yemen, targeting the country's facilities in the provinces of Hodeidah and Sana'a, killing at least 8 people. The coalition has hit oil facilities in Hodeidah. That violates a 2018 ceasefire deal that ended months of fighting in the city, which handles about 70% of Yemen's commercial and humanitarian imports. The air raids also hit the nearby Port Salif, also on the Red Sea. Saudi Arabia's warmongering policies in Yemen have so far killed hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, injured tens of thousands, and displaced millions. However, the war has stopped well shy of its goals, as the Yemeni army is gaining momentum by striking a heavy blow against the Riyadh regime. It's high time Saudis realize that they are on the losing side of the war, one in which militarily they are defeated while endangering their jewel, Aramco.
Certainly, they are losing this war. The Yemeni government, the Yemeni military is growing in strength since the beginning of the war. They are developing their own weapons and also relying on their allies to provide them with weapons. This recent strike was very targeted, very calculated, and was a big surprise to Saudi Arabia.
Yemen has announced a 3-day unilateral ceasefire suspending all rocket and drone attacks against Saudi Arabia, affirming its readiness to turn the declaration into a permanent commitment.
We announced the cessation of offensive confrontations on all field fronts for a period of 3 days, and we affirm our readiness to turn this suspension into a final, continuous, and permanent commitment in the event that the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia announces the withdrawal of all foreign forces of the coalition from our Yemeni lands and waters and a complete stop of its support to local militias in our country.
Mashat said Saudi Arabia must end its blockade on the Republic of Yemen once and for all. He said Yemen is also ready to perform a full prisoner exchange. He called on the UN Special Envoy for Yemen to take steps to prepare the agreements to carry out the exchanges. Following Mashat's declaration, the spokesman for Yemen's Ansarullah movement, Mohammed Abdul Salam, took to Twitter, urging Saudi Arabia to show a positive reaction to the announcement and prove that it's serious about peace. Meanwhile, the head of Yemen's negotiating team says Riyadh must prove its seriousness in response to Yemeni peace plan by responding to the ceasefire, lifting the siege, and withdrawing troops. The leader of the popular Ansarullah movement, Abdul Malik al-Houthi, has condemned the international community for remaining silent in the face of what he called Saudi crimes against the Yemeni people.
The United States should be supporting the people of Yemen in this war of aggression against them, but instead it is supporting the very powerful Saudi government. And it is, as you said, providing bombs, other weaponry, logistics, all kinds of aid to Saudi Arabia in their brutal and illegal war of aggression against the people of Yemen.
It has been around a month since the beginning of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the West has shown unabated support for Kyiv by denouncing Moscow's actions, providing military equipment for Ukraine, and the biased coverage of the war by Western media. Conversely, Western nations have seemingly forgotten that Yemen is the world's worst humanitarian crisis, one that the U.S. and several Western states have contributed to its making by providing arms and logistic support for the Saudi-led coalition.
Saudi Arabia's brutal war on Yemen has entered its eighth year. In March 2015, Saudi Arabia, in collaboration with a number of its allies, launched a bloody war against Yemen. The United States and several Western countries, including France and the UK, provided the Saudi-led coalition with arms and logistics support. The armaments that the U.S. has been providing the invading coalition have included precision ammunition, which the Saudi-led aggressors have been using amply against residential areas and other civilian targets. Soon after Riyadh began the war, the Pentagon started assigning a commando unit to the border between Saudi Arabia and Yemen to help the kingdom in the face of Yemeni defense forces' increasingly sophisticated retaliatory attacks. American military personnel have also been attending command and control centers on the Saudi and Emirati territories so they can best advise the countries about how to proceed with the war.
The Saudi regime, along with the UAE, backed by the United States and its allies in the region, including most notoriously Israel, continue to push for a wide-scale military operation against Yemen and the Yemeni people.
The objective was to return to power the former Riyadh-backed regime and to crush the popular Ansarullah resistance movement, which has been running state affairs in the absence of an effective government in Yemen. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abd Rabb Mansur Hadi. As protests gripped the country, the Ansarullah resistance movement took control of the capital Sana'a, following a rapid advance south from their northern stronghold of Sada'a. The popular protests were against the incompetent and corrupt regime in Sana'a, backed by Riyadh. In a bid to crush the resistance and reinstall the Hadi regime, a Saudi-led coalition launched a ferocious bombing campaign on the neighboring Arab country barely 6 months later.
They are fighting against these imperialist forces that are coming to destroy Yemen. And so we see that continuously the Saudis, along with Sudanese mercenaries, the UAE, and other mercenary forces, backed by U.S. and Israel and NATO countries, continue to provide weaponry to bombard and kill indiscriminately civilians, to destroy civilian infrastructure.
The ferocious bombing campaign on Yemen and the subsequent war that was launched in the country has stopped well shy of all of its goals. But the war has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has turned the entire country into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The United States military-industrial complex, the national security state, along with its regional and international partners, continue to push for war, continue to push for the destruction of the Houthi forces, and want to see a Yemen that is under imperial domination and that is beholden to Washington, to Tel Aviv.
The Saudi-led coalition has been preventing fuel shipments from reaching Yemen while looting the impoverished nation's resources. UN officials estimate that more than 3 million Yemenis have fled their homes due to the war. Nearly 300,000 people have also sought asylum in other countries. Internally displaced Yemenis often must cope with a lack of food and inadequate shelter. Many Yemenis who have not fled are also suffering, especially those in need of health care. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, describes the conflict as a living hell for children, with 1.8 million under the age of 5 suffering from severe malnutrition. The UN has said it needs billions of dollars to help the 17.2 million people. According to the UN Office for Humanitarian Coordination Affairs, more than 23 million out of the 31.9 million people in Yemen face hunger, disease, and other life-threatening risks as the country's basic services and economy are collapsing. The war has also devastated Yemen's infrastructure. Dozens of schools, hospitals, health facilities, factories, and refineries have also been destroyed.
But we've seen also the Houthis gain the upper hand. In recent days, Yemeni forces have taken a wide swath of territory and just recently have targeted, again, Aramco oil facilities. So this war shows no sign of letting up. But it's clear that the Yemeni people will continue to fight and to struggle for their national liberation and for their right to self-determination.
However, Yemeni armed forces and allied popular committees have grown steadily in strength against the Saudi-led invaders and have left Riyadh and its allies bogged down in the country.
U.S. President Joe Biden has stirred up controversy after suggesting that his country could lead the world. Speaking at a business roundtable meeting, Joe Biden referred twice to, quote, a new world order. The phrase quickly became a trending topic on social media on Monday. On the surface, a new world order means a dramatic paradigm shift in international affairs and a change in the balance of power at the global scale. But what the U.S. president didn't consider when uttering those words was the connotation they carry with them. New world order has for years been used by conspiracy theorists to mean a situation in which a secret cabal of governments take matters into their own hands to form a multinational totalitarian and oppressive regime. Which definition Biden might have been going for is beside the point. The main issue is that he took it upon himself to lead the world. The statement is a fundamental rejection of the world's multipolarity.
We have to always bear in mind that those who are in power, the hegemonic powers of the world, in particular the United States and their European allies, as well as the Zionist entity, they're always planning and always plotting, if you want to use that word, on how to further increase, how to maintain, how to strengthen, how to bolster the power that they already have.
How can the U.S. and its Western allies sideline their rivals, including Russia and China, that are superpowers? The West has been announcing new sanctions against Russia since it began its special military operation into Ukraine. Russia's financial and energy sectors have been under the West's crosshairs.
We are determined to continue to impose costs on Russia to bring about the end of this brutal war.
But Russia was already under sanctions before the conflict even started. This has had many speculating that the West might have been looking for an excuse to increase pressure on Moscow.
These people, these people in power, and I'm talking specifically the United States here, they are trying to get rid of these hurdles, which they consider to be very bothersome impediments to their power projection. So the United States at this moment is trying to completely get rid of the national sovereign powers that still exist in the world, for example, Russia, China, Iran, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, you know, all sorts of countries that are refusing to bow down and to accept the globalist world order. These countries are now in particular being targeted.
But such pressure would backfire at those imposing them too. The most basic example is the EU's reliance on Russian energy. At a time when the bloc faces an energy crisis and soaring consumer prices, sanctioning a major producer of gas, oil, and wheat doesn't seem like a sound plan. Russia isn't sitting idly by. Moscow has been planning initiatives to cushion the blow of sanctions on its economy. President Vladimir Putin announced this week that his country has drawn up a list of, quote, unfriendly countries that need to pay for their energy purchases from Russia in rubles. U.S. President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office, promising to bring back diplomacy and to reverse his predecessor's misguided policies. 14 months into his presidency, however, he is following in the footsteps of the Donald Trump administration. How much longer will it take for the U.S. to realize that the unipolar world is no more?
U.S. President Joe Biden has claimed that his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin's back is against the wall and that the Russian leader did not anticipate the strength of NATO's unity in supporting Ukraine. This is despite Ukraine's president Volodymyr Zelensky lashing out on a regular basis against the North Atlantic Alliance's lack of support for his country in the face of Russia's military operation. Nevertheless, Biden claims Russia's accusations that Kiev has biological and chemical weapons means Putin is considering using them himself in the Ukraine conflict. The White House has not provided any evidence to support Biden's claims.
Turn the tables around and begin to accuse the accuser, so to speak. This is a classic case, classic situation. So now they, rather than sort of trying to justify themselves, what these labs were doing there, why were they sponsored, what kind of research they were doing, they turn the tables around and say that Russians want to use it as a pretext for some attack.
A senior American defense official speaking to reporters on condition of anonymity has acknowledged that Washington has no concrete information of a Russian chemical or biological weapons attack. It just happens that Biden's accusation comes after Russian forces stumbled on what Moscow says are U.S.-funded biological research facilities near the Russian border, and asked the White House to explain why it financed a military biological program in Ukraine involving deadly pathogens. It's not the first time America has leveled accusations concerning the use of chemical weapons as a pretext to militarily intervene in other countries. Perhaps the biggest example is the case of Iraq, where American officials presented alleged intelligence that Baghdad was in possession of weapons of mass destruction, which led to the disastrous US-led invasion of Iraq that killed more than 1 million Iraqis. In Syria, Washington and its Western allies claimed the Syrian government used chemical weapons, and America attacked the Arab country despite evidence later emerging that terrorists who the Syrian government had been fighting were the ones who staged the false flag operations. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons even announced the Syrian government's chemical stockpile had been destroyed. There are now concerns Washington will use similar false flag operations in Ukraine.
Really inhumane thing to do. A, you know, it's immoral in terms of kind of lying and trying to blame the other side for your own faults, for your own, you know, sins. But another one, it will just simply escalate the whole thing, because to make this kind of fake attack will probably poison and destroy people, and it will just strengthen Russian resolve and Russian anger. So
Biden says that Putin knows there'll be severe consequences because of what he described as a united NATO front, but did not specify what actions the alliance would take. Some cracks have appeared in the NATO alliance, in particular among European countries.
NATO already did all it could. I don't think it will come down, to some kind of exchange of nuclear arms. But I think it's basically we continue in this war of, in the court of public opinion. So the idea and the purpose of the NATO is very simple: to justify their existence, that they're good, they're a force of goodness, as opposed to their opponents, be it Syria, be it Iran, be it Russia. Their opponents are so bad that they are willing to utilize every nasty thing in the book, and that's what we want to do. So it'll be a victory, primarily psychological.
In such cases, the issue of timing tends to come up. Biden's remarks come amid peace talks between Ukraine and Russia. The talks haven't been as smooth as many would wish. Nevertheless, there are negotiations which, for some odd reason, the Biden White House is not supporting. And that leads to the question as to why America and some of its Western allies are not backing the ongoing efforts to end this conflict peacefully.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام من كرمت عليه نفسه هانت عليه شهواته.
أمير المؤمنين إمام علي عليه السلام stated, whoever maintains his own respect in view, his desires appear light to him.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, in this truly universal persona of this first divinely appointed Imam, this living miracle of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, Imam Ali alayhi salam,
we find that these statements and these conversations and the manners and the sira and the sunnah, the lifestyle and the ways and the behaviors of this divinely appointed imam and this living miracle are truly something that have surpassed time. It has surpassed history. We find that the statements of Imam Ali alayhi salam and the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon him, is something that is eternal, just like all of the Ahlul Bayt. We find in one such instance, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that whoever counsels with the wise men will be guided to the right path. Now, of course, in our daily lives, we find that, you know, we are faced with certain problems or certain choices that we must make. And sometimes they are choices that we must make in the very sensitive parts of our life. There are certain decisions that we must make that, of course, are life-changing. For example, who we will marry, or what kind of job do we want, or what country do we want to live in? These are all very sensitive choices that we must make. Now, in these sensitive choices, we should do our own research, do our own due diligence, think about what we would want to do. But then there's another step which is very important, and that is to get advice from and to take counsel with wise men. Now, of course, you know, let's break this down into two levels of wise men. The first level of wise men is a person who's an expert in that specific decision that you're trying to make. So for example, you wouldn't go to your local baker who bakes bread to ask him about advice on a certain girl that you want to marry. That really doesn't make sense. So when it comes to marriage, you would go to a specific source to get expert advice on the situation. Now here's another level of wise men, and that is the religious wise men. You want to go and take counsel and take advice from the wise, righteous, true religious scholar. And when you take counsel from these wise men, these two levels of wise men, Imam Ali alayhi salam says that you will be guided to the right path. A very beautiful statement, a very profound lesson that we should counsel with wise men if we want to make sure that we are guided to the right path. And of course, in the end, we ask Allah the Almighty to help us and guide us on the Sirat al-Mustaqim, the rightly guided path. Beautiful lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
تمام ارزش‌ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib. This means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafi. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, the best thing for you to do is seek guidance of one who has created you, who maintains and nourishes you, who has given you a balanced mind and a normally working body. Your invocations should be reserved for him only. Your requests and solicitations should be alone to him, and you should only be afraid of him. Be it known to you, my son, that nobody has given mankind such detailed information about Allah as our Holy Prophet. I advise you to have faith in his teachings, to make him your leader, and to accept his guidance for your salvation. Thus, advising you, I have done the best that I can do as a sincere and loving advisor. And I assure you that however you may try to find a better way for your good, you will not find any superior to the one advised by me. Remember, my son, had there been any other God besides the One, he would have also sent his messengers and prophets, and they would have pointed out to mankind the domain and glory of this second God. And you would have also seen them. But no such incident ever took place. He is one Allah whom we should all recognize and worship.
We invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
And therefore, when we see these words there in Surah Ra'ad, وَمَنْ عِنْدَهُ عِلْمُ الْكِتَابِ, referring to Amir al-Mu'mineen, this is not necessarily only the knowledge about the Qur'an. It means the special gift of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to his chosen awliya, and of course the greatest among them is Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali bin Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam. It could very well refer to this ayat from Surah Waqia, fi kitabin maknoon, that this is the knowledge which is in the hidden treasure of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, la yamassu.